How could it be? December 1st. You know, I checked the calendar today. My iPhone said number one on the home screen. I just couldn't believe it was true. Maybe wherever you are feels a little bit more like December. But when I walked out of the train station this morning, the subway station, you see the... what is out there? Samaritans. Good Samaritans. Christmas music. I don't know. Not feeling it yet. Are you? Maybe you are. Maybe it's just the warm climate so far. Anyway, the tree went up in Rockefeller Center last night. And I was thinking, you know, if I owned like an 80-foot, beautiful, perfect spruce in my backyard, would I say, come on, guys, come on back here, cut it down. You can put it in a Rockefeller Center for the world to see. Or would I like to look out, gaze out my window at this majestic tree for the rest of my life? I don't know. I think I'd like to keep it in my own backyard. Think of all the CO2 we're not going to have from that one 80-foot spruce until it gets knocked over. Anyway, got a great show. It's Insight on Progressive Radio Network. My name's Mark Farrell. How you feeling out there? Excellent. We'll get through this month together. You know, sometimes it just feels kind of bleak. December, all the shit you got to do, you know, all the preparations, my God. Anyway, Brian Fischler is a great comic. He founded Laugh for Sight, and it's the 11th year coming up this coming Monday night at the Gotham Comedy Club right here in New York City on 23rd Street. He's going to be having his 11th year of Iconic Comics. Iconic Comics. That should actually be the name of his next show. Anyway, he's been doing this incredible, incredible program for 11 years, and I was happy to meet Brian right before, actually, he launched this, and I've been part of it as one of the hosts, and it's great because not only do they raise incredible money for degenerative retinal programs and research, but it's a hell of a lot of fun. So I urge you, if you're in the area, to obviously listen to the interview. Brian's going to be coming on in a few minutes to hear how incredibly funny he is in the lineup, including Robert Klein and many other great comics. And it's for a great cause. And you can also meet his dog, Nash. Also, we'll be talking about Fidel Castro. Did you shed any tears? I think not. International Day of People with Disabilities coming up on Tuesday. And Mazda has something very, very cool they've been doing for a few years now. It's called Mazda's Day for Good. It's a community-driven program. And we're going to be talking about that because I just love, certainly it gets Mazda's name out there, sponsorship, and we all understand what that's about. But the bottom line is they're doing great for communities, and communities are really doing wonderful things for the people that they serve. And, you know, I couldn't be happier about that because certainly I'm a major proponent of, you know, doing right in your community because I believe no matter what you do professionally in this lifetime, you got to give back, right? So current United States climate, a little tumultuous, wouldn't you think? Yeah. So before, you know, the whole Trump, how do I say this? This intrepid, disgusting, far from palatable campaign, et cetera, came about. You know, I was pretty free about my politics. But as soon as it started, obviously, flash forward to getting very, very serious with Trump and everything, I realized, okay, I got to kind of keep a lid on it. And now that he won, I don't talk about it to anybody. Unless I really know their political standing and if they're open-minded. But the reality is, I think, actually, I'm in like complete denial about what our country, the condition of our country. I thought I was a very in-touch, you know, finger-on-the-pulse kind of guy. But I realized that over the past 3 weeks or so, since the election, that our country is incredibly angry and full of hatred and quite insensitive. Now, this is a macro statement here. Of course, not everybody is. But I guess the ugliness that has been spewed for the last 3 weeks or so sounds like it's being spewed from the rooftops, mountaintops, and the reverberations are everywhere. There are more hate crimes reported, a major uptick in bullying in schools because everyone thinks they have a green light. So this made me think, now for the last 8 years, has everyone been biting their lip because we have an African-American in the White House? Like, I thought we were pretty much past all this, or certainly accepting of people's differences to a certain degree. You may not agree that Obama was a good president, and that's fine, but you can't judge him on the basis of his skin. But apparently, a lot of people do. So I can't imagine what these last 8 years were like for them. I guess it's going to be like, what's the next 4 years going to be like for myself and for anyone else who can't even consider the unfathomable that we have put a person who is far, far from capable in the White House. Now, I know politics is not my thing here. I never say it is, but certainly when it affects, you know, communities and states and things of that nature and that caliber, I think it's just so important to speak about, especially when it, you know, it's hitting the workplace, when it hits schools. You know, I speak at schools all over the country, and when I hear about, you know, teachers saying things and losing their jobs, rightfully so, that it's just deplorable. You know, I just thought that, you know, we were so far behind or beyond this. You know, I just gave us much more credit. And it's sad to think that students are spewing this, you know, rhetoric. And of course, that comes from their parents. So, and that's just a sad thing to see, that parents, it's one thing if parents are very, very disgusted and have hatred and disdain, etc. But to ingrain that into your child or children, that Muslims are no good, they should be not allowed into the country, Mexicans should be deported, we should not have an African-American president, we should not have a female president, etc. And the list goes on. And that just makes my skin crawl. So regardless of your affiliation, I just think it should be about decency. I don't know. Call me a fool. What do you think? Love to hear your feedback. 888-874-4888. Let me know what you think about this. The current U.S. climate. I mean, the uptick in reports of hate crimes. Schools have been reporting. States have been posting the cumulative reports, because it's law, about bullying. Because I think the floodgates have been opened. Because, as I mentioned, I feel as if, this is my interpretation, that it's like open season, open firing time, that people have been biting their lips who are not, maybe have some racist bones, sexism, misogynistic tendencies, whatever. But I just feel that it's just not warm and fuzzy out there, man. And listen, I'm a realist. I get that. And I don't want people to not... Hey, this is why we live here, right? Able to speak your mind freely. And but then again, you know, when the president-elect says you can't burn a flag and you will lose your citizenship. And what else did he say? But the reality is you can burn your flag, because that's, yeah, you're right. It's called the thing called, what's that thing called? Yeah. Donald Trump, get on board. Also, you know what I read the other day? That you actually, I'm not sure if this is a law. I believe it is a law. Congress passed something years ago that citizens cannot be threatened to lose their citizenship, because obviously it's a threat, number one. But, you know, the First Amendment, freedom of speech, man, it says it all. But then again, here we go. We have a president-elect who's, regardless of how ridiculous he sounds, saying that, you know, you can't do these things, they're against the law and or tolerated. So anyway, so here I want to get off my soapbox. But the reality is my wife and I had spoken about this when we were on a cruise. I mentioned this to you when I got back from vacation, how, you know, uncharted territory our country's in. We've never been in a situation like this. And so we realized that, you know, when politics is usually spoken kind of freely, that we probably would have to kind of curtail our talk, and or unless we were in circles of people we know. And I think it's great, certainly, to talk to people from different parties, because firstly, I love talking to people from all different worlds, parts of the world, backgrounds, perspectives, insight, et cetera, because how don't we grow? We have to grow because we hear and learn different opinions. And that's what it's all about. I mean, if you watch whatever you are, Republican, Independent, Democrat, if you only watch and or read and listen to people with that viewpoint, you know, you can't really open your mind. It's good to listen to people on the other side, whatever your side is. So again, it opens minds. So, but I realized that, you know, I think this is good advice. I think we should probably plan on kind of, you know, not doing this. Certainly on PRN, right here on Insight, we certainly have the platform to do such a thing, and that's why you listen to the Progressive Radio Network that was formed by Gary Noel, who, by the way, is on at 12 noon today. We embrace that, and you should embrace that as well. But it's interesting to see how workplaces are having to remind employees of EEO, Equal Employment Opportunity, policies, proper conduct, because, again, the floodgates are open. It's just crazy. It's kind of crazy, man. I can't wrap my head around it. Anyway, so speaking of wrapping your head around anything, so last night I teach spin. I've mentioned that before. Spin is, you know, that one wheel bicycle. I do that. I've been doing it for probably about 5 years now because I'm a road cyclist. I love road cycling. I like spinning a lot. It's not my favorite form of cycling, obviously, because it's indoors and it's not real, but it keeps you in impeccable shape and burns calories, and it's just good for your mental and physical condition. So I started doing that. So I do it at an ungodly time of the morning, 5:30 in the morning or 6 o'clock in the morning. So every 2 years, you got to get certified as a spinning instructor, and also to keep your CPR certification, cardiac pulmonary resuscitation. Certified, because if someone kicks on the bike, falls over, you got to be able to know what to do. So last night, check this out. This is pretty hysterical. Last night I'm in his class, not a big class, like 7 people. It's about a 2-hour class. So they have, I call them dummies, but they have mannequins on the floor. So it's like a half torso or full torso, no legs, no arms. And you can breathe into this mannequin. I'm going to call it a dummy. I like dummy. Dummy is a better word for me. You can breathe into the dummy, into the nose, into the mouth, and it really kind of replicates exactly what would happen in a crisis situation. So here I am going along. The instructor is pretty loose. He's very knowledgeable. I'm making, of course, some jokes here and there, you know, because it was that kind of setting. It was good. You know, got to pass time. Got to have some levity. So we get down on our knees, and you actually have to, you know, perform compressions. Now, compressions are like when your arms are straight and you push down on a chest, which I found out years ago, you absolutely can and probably will break someone's rib cage, which is kind of gross sounding. But hey, they'd rather have broken ribs than dirt thrown on them 6 feet under, right? Yes, they would be alive. So I'm standing there or sitting there, and I happen to catch, you know, a glance on the woman to my right, and she was a knockout. I'm like, wow, I haven't seen this woman in a gym before. She may teach at this gym, or she may teach at another gym, or who knows. But anyway, she needs to be certified in CPR. So, you know, we're not really talking. So we go down, we start doing our compressions, and all of a sudden, so I'm going, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, because you got to count out loud to, that's part of the protocol. So I'm doing all this, you know, compression, boom, 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 boom. And all of a sudden, I see to my right that we're both doing this compression simultaneously. So I'm really starting to laugh, but I'm like, I can't laugh. Number one, I can't lose track of my accounting because, you know, you're getting graded for this. It's a practical. But all of a sudden I realize we're both doing this simultaneously. So all I could think about in my mind was like, this is very sexual. So here I am in the middle of a CPR class, getting recertified, doing compressions on a dummy. And there's all these other people around me. And all I kept thinking about is like, oh my God, I feel like I'm having sex with this woman next to me, but it's a dummy and we're just, our rhythm is timed. But then it became even more funny because when our rhythm was off, it was like, I'm down, she's up, I'm down, she's up, I'm down, she's up. So I was having a time of my life. That was a highlight of my my night last night from 6:30 till 9 o'clock last night. Of course, I don't think anyone else picked up on this. Because I never looked up besides noticing the woman who was riding and bouncing and doing. Yeah, okay, here we go. I need a sip. Sipping my big gulp. So that's it. But I do have to say that I did leave singing this song in my head.
Yeah.
Yeah, so that mannequin's forever going to be in my mind the next time I have to get it certified in 2 years. All right, you guys ready to laugh? Of course you are. That's why you listen to this show. Inside on the Progressive Radio Network. My name's Mark Farrell. 14 minutes after the hour, 11 o'clock on a beautiful Thursday in New York City. Gives me great pleasure to welcome a great friend of the show, Brian Fischler. He founded Laugh for Sight 11 years ago, and it's this coming Monday at the Gotham Comedy Club in New York City. Brian, how are you, my friend?
I'm good, but I'm still trying to figure out, were you trying to have sex with the dummy or the girl?
Whoever would be receptive. Obviously, the dummy doesn't have legs, and that's a great entree, Brian. That's why you do what you do.
That's why I get the big bucks.
Exactly. How are you, my friend?
Oh, I'm good. You know, it's, what, 11-something in the morning, so, you know, this isn't my peak comedy hour, but, hey, you know, coffee helps with that, you know?
11 years. You had this vision years ago, and you actually came to that stage, and you have all these icons. Robert Klein is one of them, but throughout the years, a stellar lineup. Every year, you have all these great comics coming back or new ones like Seinfeld and more, and I always just scratch my head and say to myself, wow, Brian, you're truly remarkable for what you've conceived and what you've built and consistently for these 11 years and certainly all the monies you've raised.
Well, I appreciate that, yeah, but it's 11 years and we haven't cured anything, man. Things would be the same if we weren't doing
it. Yeah, but you think how depressed we would be if we didn't, you know, have this, you know, at least laugh or sight at least. We're having a good time in the interim.
That's true. That is very true. We definitely have a good time. It's a ruckus evening. It's a fun evening. It's a great cause, you know, trying to cure blindness, and you know, nothing better than coming out. We get a decent turnout from the blind community here in New York, and hey, you know, anytime you can make somebody who's blind laugh. And you know, last year I remember Gilbert Gottfried caused a couple people's drinks to come out their nose. So.
No kidding. He was really on fire. He really was.
He was fantastic.
Pretty much as raw. He's probably one of the most raw comics that you've had in 11 years.
We've been fortunate. We've had Gilbert twice, and you know, we don't like to use the same people every year, but we, you know, so hopefully be back you know, next year or the following. And I love it. You know, early on, I remember when we were involved with a couple of other organizations that I'm not going to name. They were like, "Well, we need to tell the comedians that they can't talk about this, they can't talk about that." And I'm like, "Look, first off, you're asking comedians to donate their time. Second off, the last thing you want to do is tell a comedian that they can't talk about a subject, because I know a lot of comedians that would go out of their way then to talk about that subject."
Absolutely.
Know? Yeah, and, you know, that's one thing. I don't believe in censoring, and, you know, it's all good fun, you know. Yeah, we've had, you know, it's funny because we've had sighted people come up to me that were offended about a couple blind jokes, and I'm like, really? Really? You're offended? And you know, it's a comedy club. You're there to laugh. It's
anything
it's absurd.
Goes.
Anything goes. Yeah, exactly.
So, Brian, you have a lot of creative juices in your body. You went to school for writing, or actually telecommunications, which was actually pretty insightful considering the time. We're, you know, back in Florida State, you know, in the 90s. Who would have thought telecommunications would have been so gargantuan? But you pretty much started having vision loss at a young age.
Yeah, you know, when I went to school, though, the problem was telecommunications was all they did was teach you how to work on the news. And, you know, I had an interesting career trajectory because in college, all they were doing was to teach you how to work on the news. And then in 92, I interned for NBC at the Barcelona Olympics, got to see the Dream Team play live, which was pretty cool. Got to go out and hang out with classy people like O.J. Simpson. And
That's pre-murder, of course.
Pre-murder, yeah, pre-murder. Actually, great guy. He picked up the tab, you know, who knew?
But, and Bob Costas, and he picked up more than a tab later on.
Exactly. And yeah, it was great, but it taught me I didn't want to work on sports journalism. And, you know, it was like everything I did, I ended up sending me out west to California and Los Angeles. I fell in love with the movie business, and I thought I was going to be the next great writer, producer, actor, and I'm kind of what happens. You know, you always hear those amazing stories about the great success stories, and I'm kind of the opposite. I'm like what happens when it doesn't pan out.
Well, you get great material.
you get great material. You know, it's interesting. If I would have known then what I know now, I would have gone into comedy way back then. You know, who knew and well, everything.
Yeah, well, you were in comedy back in the 90s because you kind of were ahead of the curve when you created a show on campus.
Yeah, well, that was, I was, you know, it was interesting. I basically created reality TV before anybody was calling it reality TV, and that was when I was in college and created a show, a television show, which I still have the videotapes for.
Oh, you have to upload that. Now, that's good material right there. You should upload that on Tuesday night, Monday night.
Well, it's funny because supposedly I have, and, you know, I don't even have a VHS player, but I remember there was one guy in college, and this was at the University of Florida, who went on to work for the Clinton administration. I probably have videos of him doing beer bongs and stuff that
Beautiful.
He probably wouldn't want out there. But, yeah, no, it was great. You know, and that TV show led me to a job with Warner Brothers in 94 in Los Angeles, and a buddy of mine and I drove 3,000 miles to L.A. from Florida, and I got fired on my first day.
So fired. So you lasted 24 hours. So that's a long stint for Hollywood standards.
That is. That's a career.
It's a great tenure, man.
I got retirement benefits.
Oh, absolutely. And a lot of women in 24 hours. Jeez, that's all needed, Brian.
Yeah, no, it had nothing to do with me. They fired the woman who hired me and her entire department. I ended up going into independent film, which was booming in the, you know, early 90s. I mean, I did everything from grip work to sound engineering to working the boom, and worked on a film in Hotel California before they demolished that from the famous song. Worked on a film with Justine Bateman, and I worked on like the 11 worst films ever made. A lot of them never ended up seeing daylight. I remember working on a film it wasn't Compton, but it was a very South Central Los Angeles, which was Shooting Nights, which was not a great neighborhood at the time. I don't know if it's gotten any better, but the experiences, you know, you would not trade. I mean, some of the stuff I got to do and see were just absolutely incredible. And, you know, long story short, I eventually ended up getting a creative exec job with a company called Davis Entertainment. And of course, where does our office end up being but Nakatomi Plaza from Die Hard, which is, you know, really called Fox Towers.
Good
so
for flashbacks,
cool.
I imagine.
Oh, anytime the, you know, electricity would go off, I'd say Hans Gruber must be back, you know.
love it. And then I believe, wasn't there an A-caliber celebrity who kind of walked all over you at the time? Charlize Theron?
Oh, that was at, well, no, this was back in 2000, because what ended up happening was, you know, back before everybody and their cousin was a screenwriter, I had written a screenplay that was like the flavor of the month called Suicide Notes. And, of course, it was a dark comedy that a bunch of producers were interested. It was going around town, and some producer, to kind of, I guess, cater to me, ended up giving me his tickets to the Academy Awards. So I got to go to the Academy Awards, and I'm walking in, and at the time, this was in 2000, I had, you know, that's, my vision started to turn in 97. I'd moved back to Florida, and in February of 2000, I just started walking with a cane. So I went to the Academy Awards. I walk in, you know, with that red carpet, and when you're nobody like me walking that red carpet, it's like they got a cattle prod, and they're hurrying you through. You know, you don't get to, like, walk around like the celebs do. So they're hurrying us through. So
no advantage with the cane, huh?
Even the guy with the cane,
jeez.
Yeah, they're like, shoot. And,
no surprise.
No surprise at all. And I end up stepping on this woman's foot, and she just makes a huge scene, yelling at me, screaming, made me, ends up it was Charlize Theron. And, you know, we ended up reconnecting a few years later, and she donated some autographed photos and movie posters to Laugh for Sight for us to auction off. So all, Charlize and I are all good now.
what a great, you know, intrepid story. And talk about serendipity, right?
Yeah, you know, I mean, it's just crazy how things come all the way around. That I ended up having a buddy that went to work for Charlize. I don't even remember what he was doing, and I guess he mentioned the story to her, and she felt bad, and that's how she ended up donating the autograph stuff that we ended up auctioning off to help raise a little money for research and everything. So yeah, it all circles around, you know. So it's
Brian Fischer, in 97, your eyes started to decrease. At what point did you realize that? When was the condition actually diagnosed?
It was diagnosed in 86. You know, I was a baseball catcher growing up. I thought I was going to play for the Yankees. Typical kid's story.
They still need you.
Yeah. Actually, that's the one position they got a good player at. So, but, hey, I can play second base. But, no, every now and then the ball would get by me, and I'd put my hand down, and I couldn't see it. And people would, you know, be like, well, what the hell's wrong with you? And, you know, basically, my parents, I guess, had heard about this condition. They took me to get tested, and sure enough, you know, they got the results that I had retinitis pigmentosa. And, you know, I remember I was in the sixth grade, I believe, because I remember going to school the next day. I had a girlfriend at the time, you know. I don't even remember
her
name.
Brian.
Yeah, I don't even remember her name. I think it was Jody something. Anyway, I remember saying, you're going to want to break up with me. I'm going to be blind one day, you know. And when you're, you know, I guess, what was I, 13 at the time? So, yeah, you know, I was a drama queen then. I guess I'm a drama queen now.
So back then in 86 or so, there was a fair amount of information about RP, correct?
Not like it is today.
Sure.
I remember at the time my parents actually, I don't know if they started the first South Florida chapter of the Foundation Fighting Blindness. They got involved with the Foundation Fighting Blindness. And I remember us having a phone in our house that was dedicated where other people could call up. And they, you know, if they had, you know, if they had questions about RP and my parents were there to ask it. So I don't think there was a lot of information at the time. There was obviously and it might not have been called the FFB at the time, but there was an organization that you could turn to at least get a few, you know, Gordon Gund and get a few questions answered.
How much of your high school career was impacted by your vision loss?
Not much, you know. I mean, I lived a regular life. I was fortunate. You know, I mean, 16, I had a car. And I remember I even drove at night a few times. And, you know, my parents, I would sneak out and drive at night. And I guess I was very fortunate. There was never any incidents. But I had a lot of friends, and you know, most of the time I would have them drive, you know, that sort of thing. I remember in college really being the first time that I stopped driving at night, and it always seemed like more friends were driving my car than me. I had a Pathfinder, and actually, no, at the time I still had a Nissan 240SX.
Nice.
And, what's that?
Nice, very nice.
Yeah, and hey, you know, some girl drove a Ferrari to my high school. I remember. You remember the show Beverly Hills 90210?
Sure, sure.
I remember the first night after that show aired. I was a senior in high school, and this girl comes in. She was a little jappy, and she sits down. She's like, "Oh my God, did you guys see that show last night? That's us." And I was just like, it was sickening in my stomach and everything. But that was the kind of high school I went to. So you know, it's just funny. I've gone back to the reunions, and it's absolutely hysterical because these people, like, they're the same people. It's just they've gotten fatter.
Absolutely. Haven't we all, right? So when you went to college, you were going for telecommunications. Was there anything ever present throughout your whole life that you always felt that there was an underlying comedic inside portion of you?
I was always, you know, kind of, I wouldn't say I was a class clown, but I was always making comments and cracking jokes and everything. So there always was that comedic side. I mean, yeah, they say laughter is the best medicine. I can tell you this much. I laugh my butt off, but it's yet to cure blindness. So, you know, it doesn't cure everything. But yeah, that'd be nice if that was the case, if one day you just laugh so hard and all of a sudden your vision kicks back in.
Well,
but
we'll find
no, yeah. So, I mean, in college, yeah, there was a lot of, I was in a fraternity, so there was a lot of pranks and stuff and everything, you know, and, but yeah, there wasn't really, I wouldn't have foreseen that I'd end up in comedy, no.
Second City. A lot of people would have killed to be involved with Second City.
Yeah, but that's Second City, Chicago. I was City, New York.
But
which,
that's okay. I mean, here you are, and what year was this, post-2000?
This would have been 02, 03 into 04. And, you know, the thing about improv, which I absolutely love and I really miss now that I'm totally blind, improv is a very visual art form. And I was really good at it. But, you know, when you're doing improv, you know, the slightest hand gesture or facial expression, you have to react to that. And I got to the point where I felt like I was cheating my scene partners and it wasn't fair to them. And that's when kind of all roads ended up stand-up comedy.
So was that a hard decision to make? I mean, here you are currently thinking about, okay, you went out to L.A. You had an extremely long tenure and career out in L.A., 24 hours, and you wanted to be in the movie business, and that didn't really pan out. Now here you are, you know, round number two, and this isn't going to pan out.
It was frustrating. I mean, I was still thinking the movie business was gonna happen. I was still writing. You know, I had a lot of connections out there. I kept thinking, you know, that one of these screenplays eventually was going to pop. I think I stopped writing around 03, 04. You know, you just get to a certain point where you get so close so many times to selling a screenplay and it never happens that the frustration just boils over. And it was really when I started doing stand-up comedy where I was like, well, why am I going to write a screenplay where I'm never, you know, might never hear anything back? And I could take stuff that I think is funny and just put it into an act or stuff. You know, with me, what happened, there was a lot of depression, going blind. There was a lot of frustration as your vision's deteriorating, a lot of scary things going on, a lot of weird comments, you know, like, I remember actually it was an interview I did with you, maybe for the second Laugh for Sight, and I remember leaving your studio because it was right on Halloween. And I was walking with the cane, and some guys, there was a big parade, you know, going on down there for Halloween, and some guy says, what a brilliant costume, a blind guy.
Really?
And that's when Halloween came, my most hated day of the year.
Wow. Oh, understandably. I mean, everything that you mentioned, it's a whole new world that you undergo. Obviously, it's not overnight, and you have, you know, slow transgression over years, but, I mean, you know, that's a very hard nut to swallow.
Going blind is so much more difficult than being blind, if that makes sense. I mean, when I was going blind, I'd have to leave, you know, because my vision depended on the lighting. It depended on a lot of, you know, different situations. You know, sometimes your mind frame, you know, it's very bizarre. It's hard to describe, but and an RP is different in everybody. I know people that are older than me that could still see great that have RP, but I'd have to carry 5 pairs of glasses when I left the house. Now that I'm totally, you know, I only have light perception, it's not stressful. I just slap a pair of sunglasses on and a hat because I have light sensitivity issues and leave the house. But don't get me wrong, I would kill to have that limited vision that I had.
Brian Fisher is my guest. My name is Mark Fowle. The show is Insight on the Progressive Radio Network. Laugh for Sight, number 11, and for dogs this year. So we incorporated dogs. We're going to get to them in a few minutes. How cathartic is writing for you comedically?
Unbelievably cathartic. I mean, it's just, you know, every time, like, something like that guy being an idiot saying, what an amazing costume, a blind guy for Halloween.
Yeah, no kidding.
Every time something like that happened, like, I used to get angry about it and, you know, depressed or whatever. And now it's like, now it's just like, thank you.
Where do I send a royalty check?
Yeah, it's like, wow, you didn't just really sell. That's going right in the act.
Hey, you got any more?
Yeah. You know, it's like, really, you didn't just seriously ask that. You know, I am a comedian. I even play one on TV, but and I did not stay at a Holiday Inn Express last night. But no, it's all material now. It's all anytime something happens. You know, don't get me wrong. There's frustration. You know, especially in your own house, like when you run into a wall, you're like, I knew that was there. That sort of thing. And yeah, so there is frustration, but, you know, it's amazing. I think you get to a point where you just have to block things out and you come to acceptance.
Mm-hmm. Sure. And, I mean, you're much more resilient in certain capacities, I imagine, and certainly you have a wall that can be divided.
Yeah, you know, and it's just you use things, you know, and then for me, creatively, that was the outlet, you know, being able to take a negative, like a situation that, you know, might depress somebody or just drive you insanely mad and take it and use it on stage has been, like you said, unbelievably cathartic.
Was there a part of you that felt like that if you're giving up the movie aspect, that you're going to be losing another part of you, or was the concept of the launch of Laugh for Sight something that just said, okay, this is cool, I can put that aside for a while because here's a great outlet for myself and to do good for, you know, who knows, maybe tens and or hundreds of thousands of people with degenerative retinal disease in the United States, and also help boost my career.
Yeah, you know, I mean, starting Laugh for Sight, I started it probably after about a year, a little more than a year of doing comedy. I was like, I saw all these benefits going on, and, you know, I had a couple of connections in comedy, and I said, well, why don't we try giving this a start? And it was funny because the first Laugh for Sight is the only one that I did not book the show. We had somebody else that booked it, and, you know, we didn't know where we were going to go after that. And, we were originally involved with the Foundation Fighting Blindness, and, you know, they were the sole beneficiary the first 3 years and everything. And it was kind of really like after year three, it was like, okay, well, where are we going to go now? And, that's when we kind of took it and a new direction and everything, and incorporated and got filed as a 501c3, a not-for-profit. And I really thought the movie business, you know, it kind of helped that Hollywood really stopped making, and it's gotten even worse as the years have gone by over the last, 11 years. And it just doesn't seem, it seems like they make one or two movies a year that are good. And I didn't read comic books as a kid. I was a baseball card kid. And it just seems that everything is a comic book movie or a remake of a remake of a play that was book, that was a poster, that was a yellow sticky note on somebody's wall.
Absolutely.
Yeah. So, I mean, don't get me wrong. There's like one or two good movies that come out a year, but my writing was always very character driven and very, I was a word guy. So it was always, my scripts were always, you know, David, I would love to call it Mamet-esque, which, you know, that's probably an insult to David Mamet, who's the great,
sure.
You know, but that's what I was trying for. And obviously I have here in the, you know, on my to-do list, take suicide notes and turn it into a book or off-Broadway play, because, you know, that was the one that was the most successful, and it would just need to be updated and reworked and everything. And, you know, maybe that'll happen one day. Maybe that'll happen every year after Laugh for Sight. I think that might happen.
That sounds like some good material, and I'm not even kidding about this, for your stand-up right there, trying to decide what to do with suicide notes.
Yeah.
I mean, you can run with that in a few different directions.
Yeah. Yeah, you know, and you know, it was a dark comedy about suicide, and so that could have been the, I was performing with three other disabled comics. This was probably about 06, I want to say. We had a brief comedy tour called the Walk This Way Comedy Tour, and the reason it was called that was one of the comics had spina bifida, one of the comics, and we all walked funny ways, you know, so it was perfect, the Walk This Way Comedy Tour.
Love it.
We ended up doing a show at Columbia University, and it's the only place where I've ever done a show where they gave us a list of topics we couldn't talk about, which, yeah.
Well, you had a good excuse because, it's not in Braille.
Exactly. I was the one comic where they read the list to me, and there was nothing there that, you know, that, I guess suicide is a big problem, and I don't get that. I guess suicide's a big problem at college nowadays.
Oh, sure, big time.
Yeah, and I wouldn't go into the other issues because they're hardcore issues. But, it was the first time I've ever performed anywhere. And it's just funny. You think of Columbia as this liberal college and everything, and they're the one place that I've ever performed where we got a list of topics you couldn't talk about.
So when you reach out to the Seinfelds of the world, Robert Kleins, Joy Behar, Stacey Pressmans of the world, is it a pitch letter? Is it a phone call? Is it a contact? And do you think the fact that certainly you have a lot of credibility going into your 11th year this Monday night at the Gotham Comedy Club right here in New York City, that it actually kind of helps that the founder and CEO, whatever your title is, Brian, whatever fancy title you gave yourself, is actually blind?
I go with czar. I find that czar is...
Looks good on letterhead.
Yeah, looks good on. I just like the way the C and the Z look next to each other.
Yeah,
you know?
And it sounds sexy when you say it to a girl.
I'm
the czar.
What do you do for a living? I'm the czar of Laugh for Sight, you know. So
and Nash, yeah. your guide dog is your czarette?
He is dictator in waiting.
Oh, good, good.
Yeah.
I love it.
So, yeah,
okay, please continue.
But, it always depends on the relationship. I mean, every relationship's different, you know, and Some people I deal with them directly because of the relationship. Others I deal with an assistant that they have, or and some it's a publicist or a manager that I've built up, you know, pretty healthy. You know, it's all about relationships. Mm-hmm. Anytime you're doing anything like this,
everything's about a relationship. Sure.
Oh yeah, all about, you know, and you know, as I've, you know, it's funny because about 5 years ago, it was like, well, how do I take these relationships that I have in the entertainment industry and monetize it for my own good? And that's how I got into the writing for these dog magazines and everything, where I'm a celebrity dog columnist. And yes, people have asked me, well, how many famous dogs are there to interview outside of Lassie? And I'm like, no, dummy. I interview famous people about their dogs. But no, you know, it's all about the relationship. And, you know, you'd be surprised. Some people that I'm very close with, they're like, and that's what that – oh, just reach out to my manager. I'm like, seriously, dude? You know, that's – you know, and it's very surprising how, you know, and some people just like it that way, and others, they're like, oh, no, just, you know, you'd be surprised at some of the people. Let's just say if I ever lost my phone and somebody was looking through my contact list, they'd be like, no, this can't be. This can't be. You know. So,
bingo. Ta-da.
Yeah, yeah. So it's interesting.
In the initial pitch, Brian Fischler, do you actually say it would be pro bono, or do you wait for them to say yes, and then you say, well, you know, we really appreciate the donation of your time?
If it's somebody new that's never done the benefit, one, I'll put, you know, in a pitch letter to that, to whoever I'm writing it to. If it's somebody new that's never done Laugh for Sight, normally it's going to a manager or publicist. So I'll first explain, you know, what the benefit is, when it is, you know, whether it's, you know, because we've done four of them in L.A. and 11 here in New York, one in South Beach. And yeah, then in the second paragraph, I'll go into past performers at our New York and L.A. benefits include, and I'll put about 10 names there, and say all of the comedians that perform at Laugh for Sight donate their time. So, you know, we've gotten a few comics who have asked, you know, there was a certain person who I will not name that we were trying to get to host one of the L.A. benefits, a very big actress. And she was very interested in the hosting, and then we got the email, and it was, so-and-so wants to know, is there an honorarium? I had to look up. I was pretty sure I knew what honorarium meant.
It's a fruit basket in the green room. That's your honorarium.
Yeah, but I wanted to look up to make sure that I was 100% certain I knew it, that we were talking about the same thing. Needless to say, that person, they wanted money. They did not end up hosting Laugh for Sight in L.A. And, you know, it's the people, you know, we've had certain comics ask, oh, is there any money involved? And we said, no, you know, we're a small, very small organization. We don't have the proceeds. But you got to remember, we're dealing with local talent. So it's not like we're flying performers in or anything.
There are a few subway stops away.
Exactly.
And Robert Klein has been a staunch supporter of yours and has actually, in a certain way, mentored you as well, correct?
That's true. This will be his 10th year at Laugh for Sight. Laugh for Sight would not exist if it wasn't for Robert. We're, you know, very thankful for his involvement. He's done a great job not only performing at the benefits, but also going out and doing interviews. He went on the Late Show with David Letterman 1 year, which, you know, to promote Laugh for Sight, you can only dream about a pitch opportunity like that.
Oof.
And yeah, that was, you know, the pinnacle and everything. And you'd be amazed. You would think that the more media organizations would be interested in having the comedian on that founded it, but now they want the uber famous people, which I get, you know. And but yeah, no, Robert, you know, when I started out in comedy, he was an acquaintance of my father's. You know, they knew each other and they were in touch, and I was able to reach out to him. And I remember I sent him a DVD of a set that I had done, and he called me back and he told me, you know, you've got some good stuff here, but can you sing? I said, no. He says, can you dance? I said, no. He says, can you play a musical instrument? I said, no. He says, okay, just keep on doing what you're doing.
That's hysterical.
Very funny, very funny. Yeah, but think about it. My mentor is Rodney Dangerfield's. Rodney Dangerfield was my mentor's mentor. So that's kind of two steps removed, which is pretty cool.
That is. Wow. So
not that it's enough, you know, don't get me wrong. It's an honor to have Robert offer me any kind of feedback or advice and everything. You know, there's very few people that have had the career that Robert has had and everything. And he's just tremendous, you know, like I said.
Absolutely. So, and his wit and his intellect and his execution is priceless every year, every time you see him.
Yeah, you know, and, you know, he's getting ready to turn 75, and he's not slowing down.
Hard to believe.
It is. He looks great, I've been told, for 75, and, you know, it's I guess he takes good care of himself, and we're hoping he'll be with us for a very long time. And, you know, this year we got kind of something interesting. I don't know if you noticed, because we have another Klein on the show.
Yes, I have noticed. But, you know what, I have to confess something. I really didn't think this was going to be revealed during this interview, Brian, but I got to tell you, as good as of a guy Robert Klein is, he does something every year when you're on stage to Nash. He tries to mount him. So
sexually?
You're not the only. Yeah, well, you know, I don't want to go into great detail, but, you know, I don't want to spoil your image of him. He's a good guy and everything. So let's go on. Yeah, there is another Klein.
Yeah, no. Well, that's, see, some things it's best to be blind.
Yes, exactly.
You don't
want that visual.
You know? Yeah. There's just some things you just don't want to know. But, well, he is very fond of Nash, you know. And Nash is a good-looking dog.
You know what? If I was a dog, I'd be all over that.
Yeah. Nash is a...
All right, moving on.
But, no, it's exciting that you know, it's almost like passing the torch because about a year and a half ago, Robert's son, Allie, got into comedy. And I've seen him. We've done, I think, two shows together. He's really good, you know, and he's doing it the right way. He's not, you know, oh, my dad is so-and-so, you're going to put me on. He's really working very hard, and, you know, I think people are really going to enjoy him. And, I think this might be Allie's first time at Gotham, so it's nice to be able to put him on at Laugh for Sight. And, you know, it'll be it's a first, a father and son on at Laugh for Sight, so...
Brian Fisher is my guest. Brian's been a comedic for well over a decade, and he's also the founder and host of Laugh for Sight NYC. He's been in L.A. and also in South Beach, correct?
Correct. We did one in South Beach. That was, I don't think we'll be going back. That was tough, you know, getting all the comics to fly in.
Yeah, of
the
course.
Logistics
yeah.
were tough.
Crazy. So it's this coming Monday night, December 5th at Gotham Comedy Club, GothamComedyClub.com for tickets, GothamComedyClub.com. So when you do a set anywhere else when you're not performing for Laugh or Sight, I imagine it's one way. Now, do you feel any difference in terms of the way you perform, good, bad, indifferent, and or your material because of the night and the caliber of host and or other comedians that are aside of you?
No, it doesn't have anything to do with the host or the other comedians on the show. And you know, Chris Rock has said there's no such thing as a bad audience. I could not disagree further with that. And maybe when you're at Chris Rock's level and you're performing in front of, you know, hundreds to thousands of people, there's no such thing as a bad audience, but when you're at my level where you've had some success and you're doing shows and there could be anywhere from, 10 people to hundreds of people, I was doing two shows on the Queen Mary out in Los Angeles. That's the cruise ship. That
Is that
came
a
back
gay
from-
cruise ship?
No, it's a very famous cruise ship.
I couldn't pass that up. I couldn't pass it up.
Hey, dude, were you or were you not on a gay cruise?
Hey, why not? You got to experience everything in life.
Not that there's anything wrong with it.
Yeah, absolutely. You should see the dinghies.
I'm going to leave that one alone.
No, please
do. Hey, who's the comedian here?
Exactly.
But, the Queen Mary, my grandfather actually came back from World War II on the Queen Mary. So that's kind of cool.
Very cool.
He came back on it, and I'm doing two shows on it. First show goes great. Second show, I'm going to let you in on a little secret. Comedians do the same material if they're doing, you know, it might be a couple things a little different here and there. But so I'm doing the same exact material, which worked great at the early show, and I'm getting no laughs whatsoever. I mean, it's just crickets. And I came up with the best ad lib line, which I will never top. I just popped into my head. I said, what are the odds? A blind comic and a deaf audience.
That's great.
No laughs.
Still nothing. No laughs.
Yeah, I just knew, you know. Larry David was notorious for going on stage, looking around. If he didn't even like the look of the audience, he wouldn't perform. No, I don't think so.
Really? I could definitely see him doing that easily.
Yeah. So I agree more with Larry David. It's really about the audience. I mean, you could have 200 people in a room, but if they're not there to laugh and have a good time, I mean, you still got to be good, but you really want the audience, and that's the great thing about Laugh for Sight. We normally get, you know, a decent amount of blind people who, yeah, most blind people have a pretty healthy sense of humor, but the people that come to Laugh for Sight, they're there to have a good time.
Yeah, and alcohol is being served.
Alcohol is as
crucial.
Long as it's not, as long as it's not too much alcohol, because too much alcohol could cause a bad thing. Then you get a bunch of hecklers and
people are emboldened.
Yeah, I don't mind a heckler if they're smart and witty, but most hecklers are stupid. And they don't realize that I have the microphone, so they're always going to lose no matter what they're saying.
Do you prefer a venue such as Gotham Comedy Club where it seats about 100, 150 people, where it's quite intimate, you can actually hear people rustling their drinks, their ice clanging in their drinks, or do you prefer a larger venue where you're more removed?
Gotham actually seats 305, believe it or not. Yeah, so
I'm glad they told you that.
because the way it's designed, I guess, it looks like it seats, you know, X amount of people. But, yeah, no, it's a nice-sized club for New York. I think that's kind of the perfect amount, 300. I do like some clubs only hold 50 people, and it's very intimate, and you're right on top of the audience. I do. With comedy, you want to be right on top of the audience because it's more interactive. And
it's palpable.
Yeah, you know, when, you know, it's luckily I've never done any clubs where you're performing behind chicken wire or anything.
Yet, hey, it's only December, so you never know what 2017 holds.
That's true. There's always something coming up, you know. So,
is there anything that you've written that you felt you could get away with more because of your blindness?
Oh, definitely. Definitely. And I do like to push the envelope. And I've written a few things where I'm, like I said, I'm a politically incorrect kind of a guy. And I've written a few things and I'm like, oh, that is so good. But I just can't use that. I can't even use that on Facebook. I can't use it because I'll test things out on Facebook. Sometimes I'll write some sentences just to throw them out there and people will be like, really? That happened? I'm like, you do remember I am a comedian. And
that is a good test pool. Yeah, I like it.
Just to see what kind of response it gets. I've got a bar over by me where I live that, you know, they do live music and I'll be able to go over there and go up. And it's a hardcore crowd, you know, where I could test out material. And, you know, I know if it bombs there, you know, then when I'm doing the big clubs like Gotham, that not even to do that and everything. And I have a bit that I'm going to be doing this year, which I haven't yet to do at Gotham. And it's one of the more risque, you know, bits out there and everything. So I'm looking forward to seeing how it goes over at this year's Laugh for Sight.
Now, certainly you have a protocol over the lineup. How is that to insert yourself where you like to insert? What do you take into consideration?
Well, it's funny because we'll put the lineup together in the order. You know, so sometimes you have certain comedians who either A, they can't stay late because they got to get up early the next morning, like Joy Behar this year, or B, you have Jessica Curson who's doing a couple shows a night, and she's got another, you know, she's coming to do this, and then she's got another show. So there's a lot you have to take into consideration, and you also have to take into consideration the flow, the styles of certain comedians. You know, you don't want a low-energy comic going after a high-energy comic because it brings the tempo of the room down. So there's a lot you have to take into consideration. And, you know, I used to talk with the owner of Gotham to get his input, but now I've gotten to the point where I know what to take in. So I put the lineup together, and you have different comics doing different amount of times because, you know, the show, you really want to keep it under a certain time length and everything. So there's a lot that you have to take into consideration. And I just kind of put that all together and use my best judgment. And, you know, last year it was funny because we had, for example, we had Bonnie McFarlane who was supposed to open the show last year. And then Rich Voss was going to go, and it ends up Bonnie had to film a video, and she couldn't wait around any longer. So regretfully, you know, she's done the benefit three times. She had to leave. So then Voss is like, well, I'm not going first.
He's a good guy. I mean, they're both great people. And the fact that, you know, I really appreciate you letting me be a part of this for, I believe, all 11 years, Brian.
I don't think you were involved the first
year.
The first year? Because the first year was different. It was I really wasn't running things. I just really performed the first, and that's the stressful thing is nowadays, because I'm so involved, it's, you know, you go from, you know, just making sure everything, you know, during that, and that's why I do appreciate, you know, your help and everything, and, you know, making sure everything, I want to be as hands-off as possible during the auction portion of the show and everything, just because I'm trying to, you know, make sure that my material's in line, I'm just trying to make sure everything's going smoothly, that everybody gets in okay, they're getting seated okay, and, you know, then I have, normally I go on the stage very early. I like to go up early, that way I could have some adult beverages after I go up and not really have to say, well, I'm not going up till the end of the show.
I hear you, my friend. Well, you glossed over one of the most important things besides you and Ash being on stage, the free portion of the show.
Yes, the cocktail hour.
Yes.
That. Yeah. We're very fortunate to have some great liquor adult beverage sponsors who provide us with a free cocktail hour. So, yeah, I mean, you really get your money's worth. I mean, this year, we even lowered ticket prices this year because we're really hoping to pack them in. So this is the cheapest tickets have been in years at $40. And, I mean, if you come for the whole night, you're really getting your money's worth. You know, it's $40 plus a two-drink minimum, and then you have $125 with an open bar. Mm,
and that's during the show. But before that, 7 o'clock for the Scion Auction, it's free drinks.
Yeah, free drinks.
Bring it on, baby.
8:30, exactly. And,
where are you going to get that in New York City? That's no laughing matter.
No. And, you know, this year we're working with an organization called the American Fundraising Foundation that have put together 10 spectacular bucket list vacation packages.
Fantastic.
That, I mean, this is stuff, you know, that it's dream vacation packages that we're going to be auctioning off.
And we're short on time, Brian, and also the New York Mayor's Office for Alliance is part of the event this year?
It's the Mayor's Alliance for New York City Animals.
Yeah,
yeah,
there you go.
They'll be providing a special needs dog adoption.
Fantastic.
As well. So even if you hate blind people, come on out to support the doggy adoption.
How could you hate a guy like Brian Fischer? GothamComedyClub.com, GothamComedyClub.com. Hats off to you, my friend. You've done a stellar job for 11 years straight here, and your endurance and your ability to be creative and to wrangle such incredible comics year after year, and more importantly, raise critical funds for degenerative retinal diseases is awesome.
Thanks. And one quick thing for you. I know you're a motivational speaker. I just have to ask, have you ever asked anybody if they'll be living in a van down by the river?
Hey, that's where I live. Have a great day, Brian.
Thanks.
See you Monday.
Take care. Bye.
My name is Mark Farrell. Thank you so much for listening to Progressive Radio Network each and every Thursday. If you'd like to hear Insight, this episode or past episodes, log on to PRN.FM. Where you are, go on to the Insight page. If you'd like me to speak at your school, college, or workplace, check out MarkFarrellMotivation.com. That's MarkFarrellMotivation.com. Have a great day. Gary Knowles next. So long.